Saab, an award-winning Palestinian journalist out of Amman. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says the new round of talks on JCPOA revival is focused on finding a mechanism for the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. U.S. and Russian officials preparing for security talks in January. Ukraine will be at the heart of the discussion. And Syria says its air defenses have confronted an Israeli attack over the port city of Latakia. Joining us. Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 agreement are in Vienna for a new round of talks. Tehran says the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not withdraw from the deal again will be on the agenda for talks. The Iranian top negotiator says the two sides have agreed on the issues in principle, and talks will now focus on the mechanisms and frameworks. Homa Lezgi reports from Vienna.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says the eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action will be focusing on the two issues of verification and guarantees.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that if an agreement is reached, the side that violated the deal, meaning the U.S., should remove the sanctions first. Iran should verify the removal of sanctions and only then take measures within the framework of the JCPOA.
Ali Bagheri-Kani says the U.S., which withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the administration of Donald Trump, also needs to provide guarantees it will not withdraw again or impose sanctions in violation of the deal.
Iran's rightful and logical demand has been getting guarantees from the other side, and this, as well as the issue of verification, have in principle been accepted by them. But discussions need to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bagheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrico Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homolezki, Vienna.
The United States and Russia will sit down for security talks to patch up the ongoing tensions over Ukraine. A White House spokesperson says the meeting will take place on January the 10th. Two other separate events will also happen within days afterwards. One will see Russian and NATO officials discuss security concerns. The other will bring together Moscow, Washington, and several European countries for a broader regional meeting. Russia says the planned talks will revolve around a list of security proposals it has presented to the U.S. and NATO. Among them is a demand that the Western alliance promise to give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and Ukraine. The West accuses Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow says it has no such plans. U.S. President Joe Biden signs into law a defense policy bill for fiscal year 2022, which allows a rise of about 5% in military spending. The Senate and the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly in favor of the National Defense Authorization Act earlier this month. The bill allocates $770 billion to military spending. This includes around $7 billion for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative. The plan is mainly aimed at supporting Taiwan, which China regards as part of its territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tension between Moscow and Washington. We've reached out to author and journalist Eric Wahlberg for comment. He believes that the U.S. military spending has little to do with defense. Take a listen.
The military industry, military industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine. These are just pretexts for the profits of the military-industrial complex. The U.S. isn't like Russia or Iran, countries that have experienced horrible invasions more than once. No one's invaded the U.S. It's got no enemies. And yet it outspends all of the other countries of the world. It's completely ludicrous. The consequences are the continual erosion of America's health as a viable economy. Instead of producing food and goods for the people, it produces money and it produces arms to kill other people. So it keeps pushing America to the brink. It's a completely insane situation, and just adding more money as a fuel to this bottomless pit.
The Syrian military says its air defenses have confronted an Israeli air raid on the port city of Latakia in the country's west. The Syrian army says the Israeli rockets were fired from the Mediterranean Sea. Fire has erupted in containers stored in the port. Residential buildings and shops, as well as a hospital, have been damaged in the attack. There were no immediate word on the possible casualties. Israel frequently pounds areas inside Syria in similar airstrikes. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military, as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Syria has condemned as a dangerous and unprecedented escalation Israel's plan to double the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights. Syria has vowed to use all legally available means to retake the occupied territory. Here's more.
Israel captured Syria's Golan Heights in the closing stages of the regime's 1967 war on Arab nations and annexed the occupied territory in 1981 in a move that was not recognized by the international community. The UN Security Council, in its resolution 497, adopted unanimously in December 1981, declared the Israeli decision null and void and without international legal effect. Nonetheless, former U.S. President Donald Trump granted U.S. recognition to Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian territory in 2019. The administration of current President Joe Biden, which remains critical of its predecessor for its unilateral approaches, has not taken any move to reverse the decision. Amid the U.S. blind support, the Israeli premier unveiled a plan on Sunday to double the regime's settler population in the occupied Golan Heights from the current 25,000 with a multi-million dollar plan. The land is rich in water sources. Naftali Bennett said the move has been prompted by the Trump administration's recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan and the Biden administration's indication that it will not soon challenge that decision. Syria has reacted to Israel's decision to expand the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights, calling it a dangerous and unprecedented escalation and a war crime.
Israel continues with its settlement policy and systematic violations, which are war crimes. The Golan Heights is an integral part of Syrian soil, and we will work to return it in full to the homeland by any means permitted by international law.
In the light of the U.S. backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah dismisses as ridiculous Saudi Arabia's allegations about the group's involvement in the Yemen conflict. Hezbollah says the charges leveled by Riyadh are insignificant and do not warrant a response. The Yemeni information minister also rejected the claims, noting that Riyadh is trying to justify its attacks on civilians in Yemen. On Sunday, the spokesman for the Saudi-led military coalition claimed that Hezbollah has been involved in what he called militarizing Sana'a airport against Saudi Arabia. The coalition has intensified its air raids on the war-ravaged country in recent weeks, prompting more retaliatory strikes from the Yemeni side. The escalation comes amid the Yemeni army's achievements in liberating swaths of land from Saudi-backed militants. The political rift and conflict-ridden Somalia is deepening, raising concerns of political violence. The prime minister now orders the country's security forces to take command directly from him after being suspended by the president. Have a listen.
I want to share with the Somali people that the steps taken by the former president Mohamed Abdullah Farmaajo were a deliberate attempt at a coup against the government, the constitution, and rules of the country. As the president seemingly decides to destroy government institutions, and with his constitutional mandate already having ended, I'm telling the Somali people that the federal government of Somalia, performing its constitutional duties, especially in this transitional period, is fully responsible for leading all the government institutions. I order all Somali national forces to work together under the commands of the office of the Prime Minister from today onwards.
Rubble made the comments after the presidential office announced the suspension of his powers, citing corruption charges and abuse of public property. The political feud between Premier Rubble and President Farmaajo has generated months of tensions in the African country. Both figures accuse each other of holding up parliamentary elections, which have been postponed numerous times. President Farmaajo has also removed from office the commander of Marine Forces. In April, pro-government and opposition fighters opened fire on each other in Mogadishu after the president extended his term without holding fresh elections. In France, national election campaigning is once again coinciding with state-sponsored attacks on their Muslim community. Dozens of mosque closures are just the latest assault on religious freedom, which appear designed to win the votes of an ever-widening far-right electorate. Rami Mazohari has more from Paris.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least two dozen shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They're entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems.
Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iraq's Supreme Court ratifies the results of the October 10th parliamentary elections that were challenged by various political groups. In a statement, the court's media officer announces the approval of the vote outcome. That shortly after the apex court rejected an appeal filed by Iraqi political parties. The ratification now clears the way for a new parliament to hold its inaugural session within 2 weeks under the law. The country has been locked in a political stalemate since the elections, in which a bloc led by cleric Muqtada al-Sadr was declared as the biggest winner. The political groups, however, contested the outcome as fraudulent, citing irregularities. The Arab country witnessed widespread protests in the aftermath of the elections, with people demanding a recount or fresh voting. Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
Farm workers in the U.S., especially immigrant workers, have few protections. They were excluded from the National Labor Relations Act passed in 1935 and the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Workers in America's agricultural fields are regularly subjected to abuses ranging from high occurrences of sexual assault and harassment, weight theft, and safety issues including injuries, fatalities on the job, and exposure to hazardous chemicals. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Michael Sainto under the heading, A Lot of Abuse for Little Pay, How U.S. Farming Profits from Exploitation and Brutality. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. In June, a farm worker from Mexico who requested to remain anonymous for fear of retaliation was transported through a trafficking network from Monterrey to work on farms in Georgia. They paid the traffickers 20,000 pesos, about $950, loaned from their mother, taking frequent trips back and forth to Monterrey before being told it was safe to leave. They were finally transported across the border. Initially, the worker was told they would be working on a blueberry farm, but was sent to a corn farming operation instead. The worker said, "We arrived at the house where we would live and had to clean the rooms ourselves. There were roaches, spiders, mosquitoes, and the mattresses were covered in lice," adding, "The bathrooms and showers were dirty and clogged. The kitchen was horrible. We had no air conditioning in hot weather." The worker began work daily at 3 or 4 a.m. local time and worked until 3 or 4 p.m. with just one 15-minute lunch break, making just $225 for 15 days of work. They heard rumors that the contractor had several workers die under them. The worker claimed that Haitian immigrants were also brought into the same network. After 20 days at the corn farm, the worker was sent to a cucumber warehouse where they weren't paid anything for their work, and then transferred to Texas before escaping the operation and returning to Mexico in July. The worker added, "There was a lot of abuse for little pay," adding, "It was a total fraud." Contractor, the worker said he worked under J.C. Longoria Cancer, was one of 24 defendants indicted on federal conspiracy charges in October based on findings from a multi-year investigation into a massive human smuggling and labor trafficking operation based in southern Georgia that extended to Florida and Texas. The indictments characterized the operation as modern-day slavery, a long-standing issue in the U.S. agricultural industry, where workers were smuggled from Central American countries to the U.S. and imprisoned as contracted farm workers. Farm workers in the U.S., especially immigrant workers, have few protections. They were excluded from the National Labor Relations Act passed in 1935 and the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Workers in America's agricultural fields are regularly subjected to abuses ranging from high occurrences of sexual assault and harassment, wage theft, and safety issues including injuries, fatalities on the job, and exposure to hazardous chemicals. The investigation Operation Bloomberg Union found the conspirators forced workers to pay fees for transportation to the U.S., food, and housing through the H-2A work visa program, while withholding the travel and identification documents and forcing them to work for little to no pay in inhumane living conditions. According to the investigation, the 24 conspirators made $200 million from their operation, laundering the money through land, homes, over a dozen vehicles, and the purchase of a restaurant and a club. Over 100 workers were freed from the operation. The H-2A visa program is an often used avenue for exploitation of migrant workers in the U.S., as it ties immigration status to employment on a temporary basis with no pathways to permanent citizenship. Many of these workers are forced to take on debts to recruiters to enter the H-2A visa program, with several cases of debt, peonage, forced labor, and human trafficking reported through the program. Daniel Costa, director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, said it's really the structure of the program that facilitates this kind of stuff happening, often with impunity. He cited a severe lack of labor law enforcement in the agricultural industry as a driving factor in widespread abuses of workers, and the lack of regulating recruiters outside the U.S. who connect migrant workers with temporary jobs. Inspections conducted by the Wage and Hour Division of the U.S. Department of Labor declined significantly over the past few days due to underfunding and the low number of inspectors responsible for overseeing a vast number of employers. Costa added, if you are an agricultural employer, there is only around a 1% chance that you will be investigated for anything in any given year, so they can pretty much get away with not treating your workers the way they should. The workers were threatened with deportation or violence if they did not comply with the conspirators. The indictments include allegations of raping, kidnapping, and threatening or attempting to kill some of the workers or their families, and in many cases sold or traded the workers to other conspirators. The indictment said at least two workers died as a result of the living and working conditions, and another was repeatedly raped. Some of the workers were promised up to $12 an hour in pay, but instead were ordered by armed overseers to dig up onions by hand for 20 cents per bucket. A grand jury indicted the 24 conspirators in a federal court in Waycross, Georgia, on counts including forced labor, mail fraud, witness tampering, and conspiracy to commit money laundering. Arraignments in the case were scheduled for December 21st and January 6th at the Southern District of Georgia Federal Courthouse in Waycross, Georgia.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the beginning of April 2011, the Syrian army was ordered to intervene after an increase in armed attacks on security forces in the city of Daraa. But it's safe to say that ordering the army to the streets was a hasty decision, because the intervention of military forces not only did not improve the situation, but also complicated it. What actually happened was the success of the opposition in trying to provoke the people in other parts of Syria and gaining international support. The intervention of the army was good media propaganda to achieve this goal, and the popular networks in the Arab world would regularly broadcast images of heavy weapons entering the cities. And people in contact with these networks would say that armed forces were shooting at the people. Syrian opposition forces.
Part 1.
Even though the military strongly denied the use of heavy weapons, no one believed it because of the intense media atmosphere created against it. The intervention of the army also provided a good excuse for Salafi scholars in Arab countries to incite the people against Bashar Assad. This effort began in Saudi Arabia and gradually spread to other countries. Although the speakers would greatly exaggerate what was actually happening in Syria, their words were accepted by the people because of the media atmosphere. The incitement of Sunni Muslims caused the Salafis in the Lebanese city of Tripoli to stage a protest against Bashar Assad. The protest of the Lebanese Salafis was significant because there were a lot of illegal border crossings in the north and east of Lebanon through which anyone could travel to Syria without any problems and transfer weapons and ammunition inside the country. Political activities also intensified with the spread of the protests and armed clashes between the Syrian army and armed groups. At a time when foreign countries had still not publicly demanded the resignation of Bashar Assad, it was necessary to determine what would happen to a post-Assad Syria. The problem was that Syrian opposition forces were not organized, and something needed to be done. A month and a half after the crisis started, Turkey began uniting the Syrian opposition, forces which could govern the country after the fall of Assad. The first official opposition conference was held in the city of Antalya and was attended by 300 opposition figures. The opposition also unveiled a new flag for Syria at the meeting. The new flag belonged to the time when Syria was able to liberate itself from being a colony of France and was known as the Flag of Independence. The flag was set aside in 1954, and now the opposition wanted to replace the flag Hafez Assad introduced as the country's official flag in 1980. On May 1, 2011, as the opposition forces were gathered in Antalya, Colonel Hossein Harmush, the commander of the 11th Division of the Syrian Army, announced in a video message that he had left the armed forces and formed a group called the Free Officers Battalion to confront the Syrian army. These events coincided with the arrival of the Syrian army in the city of Jisr al-Shughur on the outskirts of Idlib. And this was where the first clashes between the Syrian army and the Free Officers Battalion took place. The Free Officers Battalion attacked an army barracks in Jisr al-Shughur, killing 80 Syrian soldiers. Another group of soldiers who had entered the city to help were ambushed by gunmen, and 40 of them were killed. They fled to Idlib after burying the victims in a mass grave. When the mass grave was discovered, the Syrian government tried to show the world that it was fighting armed groups, not ordinary people. The Syrian army entered the city of Idlib to arrest those responsible for the Jisr al-Shughur massacre. They were able to arrest a number of them, but Hossein Harmush was able to flee to Turkey. During the clashes in Jisr al-Shughur and Idlib, some of the people in this region entered Turkish soil in order to prevent being caught up in the military operations. Turkey welcomed them with open arms and set up a camp for them near the border. Hossein Harmush would command the operations of the Free Officers Battalion from this camp. From then on, every now and then, video clips would be posted on the internet showing one or more Syrian soldiers announcing that they had defected from the army. Some would join the Free Officers Battalion. It appeared the Free Officers Battalion was seeking to establish a Benghazi-like region in the north of Syria.
During the Libyan Revolution, defectors from the military were initially able to take control of the city of Benghazi and established it as the seat of their provisional government. They then took over the rest of the country. But contrary to the initial estimates, a short time later, Hussein Harmush and the Free Officers Battalion lost their importance to Turkey. A month after the establishment of the Free Officers Battalion, Colonel Riyad Assad, who was a commander in the Air Force, revealed that he had defected from the army and announced the official formation of the Free Syrian Army. The Free Syrian Army was much more organized and had more foreign support and facilities than the Free Officers Battalion. The Free Syrian Army's command center was in the Turkish region of Hatay, and every day more people were joining it. After the formation of the Free Syrian Army, the group was apparently given the task of creating a Benghazi, and Hussein Harmush was marginalized. A month later, in August of 2011, newspapers announced that Syrian intelligence forces had arrested Hussein Harmush in Turkey, and he was returned to Syria. The Free Officers Battalion officially accused Turkey of handing over Hussein Harmush to Syria. Later on, Turkish newspapers wrote that an Alawite officer in Turkey's security apparatus named Sakir Cioglu arrested Hussein Harmush and handed him over to the Syrian intelligence forces. Turkish newspapers claimed that this security officer had been arrested but managed to escape. But The Guardian wrote that Hussein Harmush was handed over to Syria by Turkey's intelligence apparatus in exchange for seven Kurds who were accused of a bombing operation. A few days later, Hussein Harmush's confessions were broadcast by Syrian TV. As the Free Syrian Army's activities intensified, so did the Syrian military's operations. Due to the extremely high number of the clashes, the Syrian army resorted to the use of heavy weaponry, but the use of these weapons worsened the situation because the Free Syrian Army used residential areas to attack the Syrian army. The use of heavy weaponry in residential areas inevitably caused civilian casualties, and what followed was the additional condemnation of Bashar Assad's government. But as the Syrian army was making its efforts to control the crisis, Bashar Assad continued with political reforms. One of the steps he took was issuing a general amnesty to political prisoners. Many of the people who were arrested during and even before the protests were released from prisons. Some of the released prisoners were Salafis who had fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and were in prison because of their membership in terrorist groups. But after their release, many of these people formed extremist Islamist groups against Assad and became senior members of these groups. The release of the Takfiri prisoners and their role in forming Takfiri groups was so effective that later on, opponents of Bashar Assad accused him of intentionally freeing them. They believed the motive behind the release of the Takfiri prisoners was that by forming Takfiri groups, they could take over the initiative from the secular and moderate opponents of the government. Bashar Assad ordered the release of the prisoners to lessen the attacks of Salafi scholars inside and outside of Syria. And it was obvious that he had no idea of the role they would play in the developments of Syria. At the time, Islamist groups had still not entered the battles in Syria, and opposition forces were trying their best to prevent the conflict from taking on an Islamist position. They believed that talk of the emergence of Islamist leanings in the future Syrian government would scare the West, and they would not allow the formation of an Islamist state which neighbored Israel. The Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, as the most powerful political opposition movement at the time, emphasized on different occasions that it did not seek to establish an Islamic government in Syria. 5 months after the beginning of the protests, on August the 9th of 2011, the King of Saudi Arabia issued a statement which strongly condemned the Syrian government. This statement was the beginning of serious political pressure on Bashar Assad. After this statement, the Saudi ambassador left Damascus, and following that, many countries cut off ties with Syria. At the height of diplomatic pressures on Syria's government, an incident took place in the Arab world which had an effect on Syria's crisis. Libya's revolutionary forces were able to enter the city of Tripoli and brutally killed Muammar Gaddafi. The downfall and death of Gaddafi raised the spirits of the Syrian protesters, who repeatedly promised the same fate for Bashar Assad if he did not step down. The Arab League had a decisive role in the downfall of Gaddafi. It condemned the actions of the Libyan government and army in response to the protests, and had asked the Security Council to stop Gaddafi's actions. The Security Council issued a resolution giving NATO permission to create a no-fly zone over Libya. The intervention of NATO planes changed the balance of power in favor of the opposition. The Libyan army, which had already been weakened because it had delivered its strategic weapons to the West in an attempt to build confidence, was defeated. The cooperation of the Arab League and the Security Council caused the downfall of Gaddafi's rule in less than 6 months. Now the Arab League wanted to use the same successful formula against Bashar Assad. The Arab League suspended Syria's membership and announced that it will send an observer group to Syria and make its final decision based on the group's report. The Arab League appointed a Sudanese general named Mohammed Addabi as the head of the Arab Observer Group in Syria. Aside from being active in Sudan's military, Mohammed Addabi also had experience in diplomatic efforts, and after retiring from the military, he was Sudan's ambassador to Qatar for years. Mohammed Addabi and his group, which numbers 166, entered Syria on December the 22nd, 2011. During several weeks, they visited different cities which were the scene of clashes. A month later, on the 21st of January 2012, Mohammed Addabi turned in his report on the situation in Syria to the Secretary General of the Arab League, Nabil El Arabi. But despite expectations, Mohammed Addabi's report was in favor of the Syrian government and told of the attacks of the armed opposition against Syrian forces. In his report, Addabi had emphasized that the Syrian army only targets positions which the armed groups use to attack them, and there was no intention in killing civilians.
Vladimir Putin and former president, current prime minister Medvedev, both of them have noted publicly what a tremendous mistake and blunder of historical proportions it was for Russia and China not to veto UN Security Council Resolution 1973 in Libya. And I think they took this situation in Syria as a, let's call it a second chance, an attempt to redeem themselves.
Before the Russian and Chinese veto of the Security Council resolution, different groups which opposed Bashar Assad were trying to hide their religious leanings. But when it became obvious that the Security Council would not allow NATO's direct involvement in Syria, Bashar Assad's opponents decided to bring down the government by strengthening armed groups and providing them with more weapons. Even though until then, the Free Syrian Army was still the most powerful armed group in Syria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, which were Bashar Assad's most prominent opponents, decided to strengthen Salafi groups. These Salafi groups were more battle-hardened than the Free Syrian Army because of their beliefs and the experience of their participation in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Prominent Salafi groups, which became the stars of the Syrian crisis in 2012, had only been formed a few months before the end of 2011. But after Saudi Arabia and Qatar changed their policies, they were able to strengthen themselves with the support of these countries.
the most prominent Salafi group, which announced its formation only 2 weeks after the veto of the Security Council's resolution, was the front of the supporters of the people of the Levant, Syria, or the Nusra Front. The leader of this group was a 31-year-old named Abu Muhammad Julani. Based on unconfirmed reports in 2013, his real name was Ahmad Hussein Ash-Shar'a, and he was born in 1981 in the village of Ash-Shuhayl in the Deir ez-Zor district. His father was a driver for a department in the Syrian army. In 2003, when he was in his second year of college, studying to become a doctor at Damascus University, he left his studies and went to Iraq to fight against U.S. forces and joined Al-Qaeda. In 2006, after the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Julani left Iraq for a short time and went to Lebanon and started to train the Junta Sham. But after a while, he went back to Iraq to cooperate with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the successor of Zarqawi. But the U.S. military arrested him and he was in Buqa prison until 2008. After he was released from prison, Abu Bakr Baghdadi put him in charge of Al-Qaeda's operations in Mosul. A month and a half after the beginning of the protests in Syria, Osama bin Laden was killed by American commandos in Pakistan, and Ayman al-Zawahiri took over the leadership of Al-Qaeda. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi did not accept a new leadership, and the conflict between him and Ayman al-Zawahiri grew. The conflict became worse when Ayman al-Zawahiri pledged allegiance with Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. When the conflict was still not public, Ayman al-Zawahiri called on all fighters across the world to prepare for jihad in Syria. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi took a stance against the leader of Al-Qaeda and announced that jihad in Syria was forbidden. Abu Muhammad Julani and his companions began their operations in the Deir ez-Zor region in the last month of 2011. But the official formation of Nusra Front was in January 2012, and it was accompanied with a number of bombing operations in Damascus. Later on, the group released a number of hostages it had taken with the mediation of the head of Qatar's security apparatus, which showed that not only did a number of commanders, but the entire Qatari government was in direct contact with this group. The next three Salafi jihadi groups, which were effective along with the Nusra Front in 2012, were established by three friends. These three were inmates at Sednaya military prison near Damascus, accused of having ties with terrorist groups. The most famous one was Zahran Alush. He was the son of a famous Syrian Salafi named Sheikh Abdullah Alush. After learning the basics of religious studies from his father, he went to Saudi Arabia and attended the classes of the most prominent Salafi scholars at the Islamic University of Medina, such as Sheikh Abdullah bin Baz.
In the limelight.
In portraying the Zionist settler colony as a democracy with alleged human rights and coexistence between various religions, the Israeli regime has attempted to whitewash its genocidal oppression of Palestinians in the eyes of the West. We now present you an article written by Danijal Yejik, a writer and researcher currently based in Beirut, Lebanon. He has a PhD in American Studies. The article is titled, "The Apartheid Regime's Christmas Propaganda and Oppression of Palestinian Christians."
Mm-hmm.
People around the world are celebrating Christmas. Occupied Palestine, the birthplace of Christianity, remains under brutal Israeli apartheid occupation. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime targets Western Christians and with Zionist propaganda. The Israeli propaganda apparatus, Hasbara, has long invested large amounts of money and significant public relations efforts in legitimizing the Zionist settler colony in the eyes of the international audience. In portraying the colony as a democracy with alleged human rights and coexistence between various religions, the Israeli regime has attempted to whitewash its genocidal oppression of the Palestinians in the eyes of the West. As a result of propaganda attempts by the child-killing Zionist regime, many Christians in the West either ignore the plight of the Palestinians or provide outright support for the Israeli apartheid regime. Evangelical Zionists in the United States have been amongst the most radical supporters of the Israeli regime. Christian tourism has contributed to the colony's economy. This year again, Zionist politicians and officials have extended their holiday greetings to Christian friends around the world. Such greetings are packed with colonial propaganda and appropriation of history. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Naftali Bennett published a video on Christmas Eve this year from the occupied city of Al-Quds, connecting the ancient land and the Bible to the current colony in his address to Christians. Naftali Bennett, who previously bragged about how many Arabs he killed in his life, lied that the colony provided religious freedom, tolerance, and prosperity in a region where Christians are routinely persecuted. The illusion that Israel offered religious freedom and that Christians outside of the colony are persecuted is widespread in the West. Naftali Bennett claimed that Israel is the only place that protects Christian life and thanked his audience for fighting for the State of Israel. While such proclamations further add to the purported positive image of the colony in the West, they stand in stark contrast to the reality on the ground. In fact, the world's oldest Christian communities are victims of Israel's genocidal settler colonialism. As a result of Israel's ongoing ethnic cleansing campaign, the Christian population in Palestine has sharply declined throughout recent decades. Places of significant importance for Christians are cut off from the outside world. The town of Beit Lahem in the occupied West Bank, the birthplace of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, is surrounded by an apartheid wall. Besides suffering under structures of the apartheid regime, Palestinian Christians are also oftentimes prevented from exercising their religion. While foreign visitors may access Palestinian churches, the Palestinian right to worship is tightly controlled by the Israeli apartheid regime. Depending on where they live, Palestinians require permits issued by the apartheid authorities to attend Mass in churches. This year again, Palestinian Christians from Gaza applied for permits to travel to Beit Lahem to attend prayers. Their requests were either rejected or outright ignored. Palestinians are harassed by apartheid authorities on holy days such as Easter and Christmas. This year, on Easter, apartheid authorities escalated their ethnic cleansing campaign by expelling Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah in eastern occupied Al-Quds from their homes. This Christmas again, hundreds of Palestinians were injured by Israeli occupation forces when they protested against settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Israeli violence has always extended beyond the borders of historic Palestine. The Israeli colonial regime has a history of targeting indigenous Christians in the region. It has done so during its military occupation and numerous wars in Lebanon and its continuous attacks in Syria. During last year's Christmas celebrations, the Israeli regime invaded the Lebanese airspace to conduct airstrikes on Syria, killing several innocent Syrians. The Israeli regime is terrorizing Palestinians of all religions, but has been trying to portray the settler colonial conquest as a conflict that is allegedly religious in its nature. Exploiting traditional Orientalism and anti-Muslim sentiments that are prevalent in Western culture, the Israeli rhetoric has long focused not only on portraying Palestinian resistance and oftentimes the very Palestinian existence as such as anti-Jewish, but the regime has also tried to identify all Palestinians as Muslims to better advance its Islamophobic dichotomy and to frame the Palestinian struggle for freedom and liberation as a religious movement. It is the religious frame and the anti-Muslim prejudice among Israel's backers that allows the apartheid regime to advance its goals. It is thus not surprising that the Israeli project is popular among the far right and fascists around the world. Of course, the Palestinian struggle was never a sectarian one, and many leading figures of Palestinian resistance have been Christians. Nor should the religion of colonized people determine the solidarity and support they receive from the outside world. After all, destroying the cultural diversity of the region and dividing the population according to sectarian and ethnic lines have been long-established practices of imperialist and colonialist forces. Numerous Palestinian Christian leaders have appealed to Christians around the world to not turn a blind eye towards the continuous oppression and exploitation of Palestine. The Palestinian Archbishop of Greek Orthodox Church in Al-Quds, Atala Hana, himself a crucial figure